Bank versus William Hill. If counsel could please step forward. Please have appearances of counsel.
John Flynn, Assistant Deputy Public Defender, appearing for defendant petitioner William Hill.
Ronald Chen, Rutgers Constitutional Rights Clinic, representing Amicus Curiae, ACLU of New Jersey.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Assistant Prosecutor Patrick McVady for the state.
Sheehan, on behalf of the Attorney General, is Amicus Curiae.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Flynn, please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I would respectfully reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary. Unlike any other witness tampering statute in the nation, New Jersey's witness tampering statute, as currently interpreted, allows the defendant to be convicted without any subjective understanding that his speech might cause a witness to withhold testimony. No exception to the First Amendment or the broader free speech protections under our state constitution permit that result. Today, I plan to focus on 3 points. First, that the witness tampering prosecution of Mr. Hill, based on the content of his letter, based solely on an objective standard, falls below the constitutional floor set by the Supreme Court in Counterman. Second, that when applying principles of constitutional avoidance and ordinary rules of statutory construction, the best reading of the witness tampering statute is to have the knowing mental state apply such that the defendant must be aware of the capacity for a speech to cause a witness to testify falsely. And third, the carjacking conviction needs to be reversed as well, because the harm in presenting the jury with Mr. Hill's letter alongside a constitutionally insufficient objective standard made the jury more likely to view Mr. Hill's letter as reflecting consciousness of guilt rather than a proclamation of his innocence, and correspondingly made them more likely to convict on the carjacking despite the state's extremely weak evidence on identity. Turning to the first point, I would like to address and reject the state's contention that Mr. Hill was not prosecuted for a speech in this case, because that just is belied by the record. In this case, the jury was tasked with looking at Mr. Hill's letter, considering the contents of it, and judging whether that met the statutory element for witness tampering. In other words, he was prosecuted based on the content of his speech, and that's what puts this case and other witness tampering prosecutions like that within the ambit of the First Amendment. This isn't, as the state contends, a conduct-based prosecution. This was content-based. This is pure speech, and that's why, in order to prosecute Mr. Hill criminally for this letter, his speech needs to fall into one of the narrowly defined exceptions to the First Amendment. As the Supreme Court held in Counterman, if we're going to analyze this this prosecution under a true threats exception, the constitutional floor is recklessness. And here, NJSA 28-5A simply requires like a civil negligence standard as to the capacity for the speech to cause a witness to withhold testimony or testify falsely, and that's plainly insufficient. The only other exception that has been advanced is a potential justification for this is the speech integral to criminal conduct exception. But as I outlined in my supplemental briefs in my response to the Attorney General, that exception clearly requires a mens rea of at least knowledge. Every time that the Supreme Court has described that exception, they've talked in terms of intent. So for example, in State v. Hansen, the Supreme Court just last term said that speech intended to bring about a particular unlawful act has no social value, therefore it is unprotected. They used the word intent. They similarly used the intent the last time they addressed that prior to that in Williams. They said speech is unprotected when it is intended to induce or commence legal activity. Every single case that the Supreme Court has applied that speech integral to criminal conduct exception to uphold a law that it is just integral to criminal conduct, the statute has required intent or knowledge. I mean, the state has pointed to absolutely no cases anywhere where a court has upheld a statute that uses a recklessness or a negligence standard as to the capacity for speech under the speech integral to criminal conduct exception. So in short, however you slice it, what happened to Mr. Hill in this case, this prosecution was unconstitutional. And because the jury was instructed solely on an objective element, that would require a reversal of Mr. Hill's witness tampering conclusion. And I would just add to you, I did not request an opening statement, so of course I welcome the court's questions. The only other justification that has been offered, other than that this is not a speech-based prosecution, for why this isn't within the ambit of Counterman or other exceptions to the First Amendment cases, was that offered by the appellate division, that Construing the witness tampering statute the way we advocated for would somehow impair a court's ability to issue no contact order. And that kind of just is analytically incorrect, because there's a crucial distinction between a no contact order and prosecuting someone on a witness tampering statute like this one. A no contact order is a time, place, and manner restriction on speech. It doesn't depend on the content of the speech. So it's subject to a lower level of scrutiny. So rather than being subject to scrutiny, it'd be subject to intermediate scrutiny. So right off the bat, so even though you do have a protected First Amendment right to contact a witness, generally speaking, if it's not threatening or integral to criminal conduct, the state is allowed to restrict that right with a no contact order that's tailored, you know, to a specific case. And as I outlined in my brief, under both the Criminal Justice Reform Act and 2C28-5.1, there's statutory authority that basically allows courts to use no contact orders when there's like a reasonable expectation that a defendant is going to interfere with the witness or obstruct the judicial process. So when a court is making those findings based on the individual defendant before the court and the individual facts of those cases, that's ordinarily going to comport with the Constitution. It's just a completely separate analysis that applies in this case because Mr. Hill was being prosecuted based on the content of his speech.
So with regard to whether this is a speech-based prosecution, I mean, wouldn't you agree that the crime of witness tampering can be committed in a variety of different ways, including speech, but not necessarily has to include speech in order for a prosecution under this witness tampering statute to proceed?
I would agree. There are going to be at least some witness tampering prosecutions which are purely or primarily conduct-based, but I think those are going to be the outlier. The Attorney General and I both cited a ton of unpublished cases, but the essence of witness tampering is that you're communicating a message to the witness, you know, not to testify or to testify falsely.
But sometimes that message can be communicated without any actual communication, without any speech. So in this instance, even if, you know, I think part of the state's argument is, you know, the content is not necessarily what the focus was here, but the fact that you have a defendant in a trial sending a letter to a witness to her home, that is an intimidation factor that might cause a witness to engage in one of the prohibited acts in the statute. So if someone's just following a witness home or standing outside of a witness's home, there's no communication happening there, but that could still be viewed as witness tampering.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in that particular case, if it was just following a witness home, there might not be an as-applied challenge with the statute. Here, I think it's clear that as applied to Mr. Hill, I understand that the state's trying to say, like, for example, that if this was an open letter in the newspaper, that it couldn't be prosecuted as witness tampering. But what the jury was tasked with doing was looking at the contents of the letter. Both sides, the prosecutor in particular, made extensive arguments about the content of the letter. So as applied here, it's clearly a problem.
The jury was told that this came by mail to her home at her home address.
That's correct.
And that's a significant aspect of this, is that informed this victim, alleged victim, that the defendant knew where she lived.
That's correct, but the constitutional problem lies in the fact that the jury instructions simply instructed on a purely objective standard as to the defendant's understanding of the speech. There was no subjective element, which is required by Counterman, as to whether the defendant himself understood, knew, or I guess even consciously disregarded a substantial risk that his speech would be understood that way. So that's the constitutional defect. So regardless of whether you agree with me on the evidence being sufficient here as a matter of law to charge witness tampering, the conviction still needs to be reversed based on the insufficient jury instruction. And I guess to kind of transition to my second point is the question of, you know, whether this is a substantially overbroad statute, whether those pure conduct-based prosecutions that where I'm conceding that there's not an as-applied challenge would, significantly outnumber the ratio of speech-based prosecution. I think that, you know, there's going to be way more speech-based prosecutions. I think we've cited tons of cases where it's directly speaking to a victim, phone calls, letters, social media posts, where it's going to touch a lot of speech. But To invoke the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, which is my frontline position, you don't even need to go so far to say this is overbroad in its faith. You just need to say that it presents a substantial constitutional question. It raises concerns as to whether it might be overbroad, absent the interpretation that I'm advancing. And I submit that...
Our grant of certification is limited to the question whether the witness tampering statute citation is unconstitutionally overbroad.
That's correct.
That's the question before the court.
Right. And so my answer to that question would be that you should avoid that serious constitutional question by narrowly construing the statute. And that part and parcel to that question, I think, is fairly incorporates whether, because in any analysis of whether a statute is overbroad, you look at whether it's, there's actual applications of it being applied in an unconstitutional manner. I'd submit the clearest one is the one before the court. So I don't think you could divorce the question of whether it's an as-applied challenge from the question on which you granted certification. And to answer the question, I think the best answer to the question is that you could apply principles of constitutional avoidance to narrowly construe the statute. But alternatively, you could, if you conclude that the statute is not susceptible to that reading, I would support the ACLU's position that the statute is just overbroad in its face and you have to strike it in its entirety.
So let me address that for a minute. When speech and non-speech elements are combined in the same conduct, sufficiently important governmental interests in regulating the non-speech element can justify limitations on the First Amendment. And that's U.S. v. O'Brien. And Turner sets out a test. And my question to you is, does this test apply?
The test doesn't.
Let me just finish the question. When conduct regulation incidentally regulates speech, a statute will not be overbroad if it advances important governmental interests unrelated to the suppression of free speech and does not burden substantially more speech than necessary to further those interests. And of course, here we know the governmental interest is deterring witness intimidation. Is that the proper lens through which we should be looking if we deal with the specific question that was certified?
So I have a two-part answer to the question. My first point is that the O'Brien test does not apply because this case isn't like that. This isn't a statute that just incidentally burdens speech. So in O'Brien, for example, the conduct at issue was burning draft cards. And what the Supreme Court held in that case was that burning draft cards is primarily conduct, and whatever symbolic extension it might have is purely incidental to that conduct. Another case where the Supreme Court applied the O'Brien test is Virginia v. Hicks in 2003. It was a trespassing statute where someone was liable for trespassing if they had been served notice about not coming back to this housing project and then did so anyway without a legitimate business purpose. And again, in that case, the court said the Turner test will apply, that the O'Brien test will apply because it's primarily regulating conduct and only incidentally burdens speech. Here I would say the witness tampering statute is kind of the opposite. As I said earlier, the essence of witness tampering is communicating the message to the victim. So it's really speech that, like, incidentally might also have conduct attached most.
Although the statute uses the word knowingly engages in conduct.
That's correct, but I don't think that label governs, is dispositive here. Just because it's labeled as conduct, I still think it's primarily a speech-based statute. But
there's a lot, like we discussed earlier, there's a lot of ways to communicate that message to a witness. We had an argument earlier that involved witness tampering, and I don't think there was a single First Amendment issue to be found in that particular witness tampering prosecution. So there's just a lot that can be, there's a lot of different ways that this particular crime can be committed aside from speech. That communication to witnesses, not to testify, to recant, that can happen in a lot of different ways aside from speech-based.
So even if you disagreed with my first position and said the O'Brien test does apply, it still wouldn't pass the requisite level of scrutiny because it does burden substantially more speech than necessary. So I started off my presentation by saying every other witness tampering in the statute requires a mens rea of at least knowledge. So having this civil negligence, this isn't even criminal negligence defined by the code, this is a pure reasonable person standard, would be significantly lower than anywhere else in the nation does it. So in these conduct-based examples where, you're following a witness, the state's going going to have absolutely no problem proving to a jury that a defendant has knowledge that that conduct might cause a witness not to testify. So the tailoring is the problem. So even if you were to apply a lower level of scrutiny, this intermediate scrutiny to the statute, that'd be one, there'd be this way more narrowly tailored ways to protect the state's compelling interest. Moreover, as I previously discussed, there's the whole non-content-based prosecution for contempt for violating no-contact orders. So this, for example, like a case like RAV versus City of St. Paul, the Supreme Court said, when there's content-neutral ways of regulating speech that achieve the same results as content-specific ways of regulating speech, that's a problem with tailoring. Ordinarily, we would say that the content-neutral ways are the better way to do it, the more tailored way. So even if you were to apply a lesser level of scrutiny to analyze this statute, it would still be a problem, and I would still say that knowledge would be the requisite mens rea. And moreover, I still think even if on its face you wanted to analyze the statute that way, you'd still run into as-applied problems like in this case, when it's pure speech. There really wasn't any conduct attendant to what Mr. Hill did here. And if the state wanted to prevent
Mr. You agree that the victim testified that the letter made her scared to testify because it made her realize that the defendant, who was an otherwise stranger to her, knew who she was and knew where she lived.
That's right.
So in theory, that would have been the same even if the envelope had been addressed to her and inside was a blank letter, but it just had defendant's return address on the envelope, correct?
In theory, that'd be correct.
And you said it. We know here that the content of the letter really mattered because of how much the prosecutor focused on it. Which particular sentences of the letter was the prosecutor focusing on to show that that particular sentence was a threat?
So he didn't focus on as much as he wanted to because it got objected to and because he was kind of characterizing the letter.
Just repeat that.
So he wanted to read portions of the letter and there were objections because it seemed to be trying to make an argument that he must have known what she looked like from committing the crime and not from watching the video for identification, and the judge ruled that they shouldn't go down that route. But what he said, the prosecutor said, was he said, take a look at the contents of this letter. It would be a lazy analysis to think that this is just an innocent person, professing their innocence. And he goes, it's your question. You look at the contents, right? What is he saying to her? What is he trying to do? What is a reasonable person to take from it? I'm not going to say more than that, but that's for you guys. Read the letter. And then in deliberations, the jury requested a copy. Well, so they had a copy of the letter with them, but it was handwritten. So they requested a typed version, which wasn't in evidence. So they then replayed a detective reading the letter. So the jury was looking at the contents of this letter in toto, really, to try to determine whether it met the elements that they were charged to determine.
But wasn't the prosecutor's focus the fact that this was a letter sent to her individually, not an op-ed in the newspaper, but a letter sent to her individually at her home address and from him?
The prosecutor did mention that in closing, among other things. But the constitutional defect, again, is the jury instruction. So regardless of whether the fact that it was sent knowing that her home address from an incarcerated defendant, whether that was sufficient to meet a constitutional mens rea of at least recklessness, which is the floor under Counterman, the jury just simply wasn't asked to determine that. And even under plain error review, when the jury's not instructed on an essential element of the offense, such as the requisite mens rea, reversal is required. So regardless of what hypothetically how this prosecution could have went differently or what might have been the jury's motivation for finding Mr. Hill guilty of witness tampering, we don't need to speculate because they just simply weren't required to find the constitutionally required mens rea.
Why would Counterman apply here? I thought in Counterman, the U.S. Supreme Court defined a true threat as a threat of imminent violence. Whereas here, witness tampering is a crime of the third degree only if it does not involve force or the threat of force. So how do we even get into the land of true threats if we're talking about a conviction for third degree witness tampering, which is by definition no force or threat of force?
So I would agree that maybe it's not always the best exception to apply. I mean, we briefed it that way, and then in hindsight, it came up in the briefing, the speech integral to criminal conduct exception. I think that exception would probably actually fit the third degree crime a little bit better. So consider, for example, a defendant just knows a witness as a friend with the witness and says, hey, you're my friend. We've been friends for a long time. Please testify falsely on my behalf. There's no threat there. There's no pecuniary promise or something, but the state's still going to want to prosecute that as third degree witness tampering. that would be prosecutable if, you know, there was an element that I'm advocating that the defendant knows that that speech is going to make a witness testify falsely, that defendant has knowledge or intent for that. That would fall within the speech integral to criminal conduct exception because it's speech that's integral to getting that witness to commit perjury. So I think that example and some of the other examples are probably better analyzed under that exception rather than true threats. And that might have just been kind of like a defect in the way we briefed it initially, and I apologize for that. But either way, like either exception is going to require either recklessness as the federal floor for true threats, if it's going to be threatening speech, or I would submit at least knowledge for speech integral to criminal conduct. And just one other point, too, in terms of the tailoring. So the state has a more narrow way to prevent witnesses from sending letters from prison to victims' homes, and that is using no contact orders. You know, it's not a heavy burden that they have to prove to get that contract neutral no contact order. You know, defense attorneys probably aren't really going to, of course, they'll advance their client's interests, but they're not really going to have an incentive to oppose a no contact order in most cases. Defense attorneys generally don't want defendants directly contacting the victim. And as this court held last term in Ramirez, now there's even under limited circumstances that a defense attorney themselves, the defense team, might not even get a victim's address. So there's all these content neutral ways to advance the interest that the state's relying on in this case.
Sorry, he was originally charged with carjacking.
That's right.
So you're saying the judge should have issued a no contact order?
I'm saying the judge probably could have. You know, there just isn't a no contact order that was entered. In this case,
it's not usually done, right? In a carjacking case?
So you're saying it's not usually done? I'm not sure. So I'm not a trial attorney.
Are you saying that instead of prosecuting under the witness tampering statute, the state's remedy should be asking for no contact orders in every criminal case if there's a victim?
Well, the statutory authority requires there to be like a reasonable basis to believe that the defendant might interfere with the criminal justice system or interfere with the witness. So
what would that basis have been here before he sent her the letter?
Well, I mean, so this defendant was detained, which means that the court found by clear and convincing evidence that no combination of pretrial release restrictions would adequately ensure the defendant's appearance in court, promote public safety, and prevent the obstruction of justice. So probably the same facts that led to those findings might have supported a no-contact order in this case. But, I mean, it just didn't ask for one. It wasn't given. It's not there.
Is it your position normally that would have happened either upon release or maybe at the end of a detention hearing if they had been permitted to release on conditions, that it would have been a part of that?
Yeah, I mean, from my understanding from talking to trial attorneys is yes, often in like violent crimes, when a defendant is released on pretrial release conditions, one of those conditions is no contact with the victim.
And therefore, if that had been done, then this could have been a contempt charge rather than a witness tampering charge.
Right. And it also, Mr. Hill would have been on notice that he shouldn't be writing the victim. He wouldn't have to understand how a hypothetical third person might interpret his letter and be criminally liable based on that. He would have clear notice from the judge telling him not to do that. So it's just a less constitutionally problematic way under the First Amendment of achieving, you know, the same result.
Has any case, I know you said that the appellate division didn't have any basis for concluding that there's no First Amendment right of an incarcerated defendant to contact a victim by mail, their home address. Has any case ever held that there is a First Amendment right for a defendant to communicate directly with a victim who they did not previously know via a letter mailed to their home while awaiting trial for a violent crime?
I'm unaware of any case that has held that, but the presumption, especially under our state constitution too, is that speech is protected, that we operate from that. So even if speech might be alarming or disfavored or it's speech we don't like,
is it your contention that there is a First Amendment or state constitutional right for a criminal defendant to contact a victim at that victim's home address?
So not if it's threatening, then it would be a true threat. Not if it's integral to criminal conduct. So not if it's done with knowledge that it will make the person testify falsely. And even though there is a protected right otherwise, that can be permissibly restricted by a no contact order when those specific findings that I outlined earlier are made. That would be constitutional.
But other than those exceptions, your position is that a defendant charged with committing a crime has the First Amendment right to contact the victim awaiting trial.
Yes, I mean, absent those three exceptions, which I think we're going to cover like a lot of cases. I mean, I don't know like how often it is that like a defendant's writing a letter like this one that doesn't have any threats and it doesn't even ask that you know, the person to testify falsely. This letter asks the victim to think about her identification and tell the truth. So I do really think this case is kind of like an outlier case. Like, although I cited a ton of cases where it's like speech-based prosecutions, I think most of the speech that were at issue in those cases would not be difficult for the state to prove a knowing mens rea. That would make it fall into either the speech integral or criminal conduct exception or a true threat exception. You know, so although like we're operating from the baseline that that's the right that defendants have, I don't think you know, the state's interest is really undermined by operating from that baseline.
Is your answer to the questions you've just responded to pivotal to your argument?
No, it's not. Regardless of what you determine with that, Mr. Hill's conviction was just predicated on a constitutionally insufficient mens rea, so it would need to be reversed.
But you only get to that, sorry, if there's a constitutional right to contact the victim at her home, right? Because if their First Amendment doesn't apply at all, the APDIB seemed to say there's just a First Amendment exception here in that there is no First Amendment right for a defendant who's incarcerated to contact a victim at her home, period. So there is no First Amendment scrutiny at all. If that were correct, then you don't get into any counterman argument or any argument about whether you need a, in order to fall into the integral to criminal conduct exception, you need a knowing or purposeful mens rea because you just are outside the First Amendment.
Yeah, on second thought, I think that's right, Justice Wiener, after, but I think Stevens, the 2010 United States Supreme Court, is instructive in that regard, that we don't just make up categories of speech that are unprotected. That was like brutal depictions of animal cruelty. And they said, yeah, like this is like not, doesn't seem like really valuable speech, but it just doesn't fit the elements of any of our previously delineated categories of speech that are unprotected, for which there's like a historical analog that does that. And this speech here could easily fit two analogs we have, true threats or speech integral to criminal conduct, but there's no First Amendment exception for contacting a victim directly at your home. There's not a case that says that that's categorically exempt from the First Amendment. It just often happens to fall into two existing exceptions. By making sure that New Jersey's super unique witness tampering statute fits into one of those two exceptions isn't burdening the state's ability to protect witnesses. They'll still have more than adequate ways to do it. They'll still have, most of the time, very little problem proving the requisite mens rea of the jury. It's really just doing it kind of the way that it's historically been done and has been done literally everywhere else in the nation.
When your client moved for a judgment of acquittal with respect to carjacking, was the argument made that the admission of the letter tainted the jury in its deliberation on carjacking? See what I mean? That's part of your argument. That was your point three when you opened, is that the carjacking conviction should be reversed.
That argument was not made below.
And was it made before the appellate division?
Yes, it was made before the appellate division. It's point 1B of the appellate division's brief. So in the appellate division, you know, we basically relied on the same thing I'm advancing here, which is like it made the jury more likely to view the letter as consciousness of guilt as opposed to a proclamation of innocence. We cited an unpublished appellate division case in the appellate division, Williams, where a different panel had reversed where witness tampering conviction had problems because they said witness tampering kind of always inures a sense of consciousness of guilt as to the underlying crime. I don't want to go that broad. I'm not saying that every time there's a problem with the witness.
I'm just trying to find out what are we here on that issue? Because that was not something, why don't you confirm that? It was not something that appears to have been part of the argument on the motion for judgment of acquittal.
But that's right. It was not.
There were other grounds on carjacking about the strength of the evidence. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, it was focused on the weaknesses in the identification.
The trial judge never had an occasion to determine whether any ruling with respect to the primary issue you're raising today would impact the carjacking.
No, the trial judge did not have that occasion, and the appellate division didn't reach that issue because although it was raised, the appellate division just held there was no First Amendment violation.
Suppose there were no witness tampering charge in the indictment and the trial proceeded only on the basis of the carjacking. Could the defendant's statement in the letter have been admissible under 803B1 as a statement of a party opponent?
It would have been 803b1 fine, and then the question is whether it would have came in under 403, whether it's relevant to like consciousness of guilt, or if that, even if it is potentially relevant to that, whether that would be substantially outweighed by the potential for undue prejudice of kind of just like evoking sympathy for the victim, confusing the issues before the court. So I would argue that it would not come in under 403, that like the meaning of this letter would kind of distract from the main evidence. But even if that were true, even if you disagree with me on that and that it would come in maybe with a limiting instruction of some sort, I'd still be making the same exact argument as to harm, because it's the instructions that were given to the jury that colored the way in which they looked at this letter. As the prosecutor reminded them, the jury instructions told them to look at this letter from how a reasonable person would look at the letter. The jury was not instructed that it was a hypothetical third person, reasonable person.
But that concern that you're voicing goes to the witness tampering charge, not to the carjacking. No?
Because that concern, though, also impacts the carjacking, because if they're more likely to look at how the reasonable person would view it rather than what Mr. Hill intended, they're more likely to view the letter as consciousness of guilt as to the underlying carjacking than a proclamation of innocence. So if the jury had received an instruction that in order to convict Mr. Hill of witness tampering, the state needs to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Hill was aware that his letter might cause a witness to withhold testimony or testify falsely, the jury would have, as part of their deliberations, had to have considered Mr. Hill's mental state and would have had to consider, was this really a proclamation of innocence, or is this letter something that a guilty person is doing? And by lowering the burden to a civil negligence standard when they're considering the letter, it made it more likely that the jury was going to view this evidence of witness tampering as a crime and then correspondingly use it as conscious of guilt as to the carjacking. And I think, although it's, you know, maybe not the most significant prejudice in the world, it's enough to tip the scales in this case, because the state's evidence as to the carjacking was razor thin. This was an identification that was cross-racial, made in extremely poor viewing settings when it was dark out and the victim was hanging in and out of the car. Her initial description of the perpetrator lacked height, weight, didn't point out the scar that, you know, was between Mr. Hill's eye. During the array procedure herself, she hesitated multiple times. She didn't follow the instructions to do a sequential viewing and instead compared the photographs side by side. She repeatedly wavered and looked at the photographs again when the detective asked her to express her level of confidence. She said that the beard was different, the skin was lighter. She really thought another person was it. So when you look at the particular facts here, this identification has so many of the problems that this court identified in Henderson as potentially leading to a misidentification. And against that backdrop, that consciousness of guilt problem that I described with the witness tampering charge was enough to spill over and lead the jury to convict on carjacking as well. And at the end of the day, the standard for
also the video surveillance evidence and evidence that the defendant was arrested with the same clothing that she had described that he had worn, and it was somewhat specific. So it wasn't only that she said this was the person.
Right, but the defense really contested that. So if you look at the surveillance stills in the appendix, it looks like the suspect is wearing black pants. And she described the suspect as wearing faded jeans. Though Mr. Hill is arrested weeks later, he's wearing faded jeans. And there's a whole dispute about whether that's the lighting or whether they're different pants. Same thing. She said like a red or a tan hat. Then he's arrested with a red hat with a prominent logo. And the surveillance stills show like a black hat. So there was like all this, fighting back and forth during summations about whether the descriptions actually matched at all. And the defense credibly contended that they didn't. So that wasn't overwhelming evidence of guilt either. It's not the type of evidence that would be sufficient to sustain this verdict. Because at the end of the day, the standard here is whether this is the constitutional error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt with respect to the carjacking conviction. In other words, whether the impermissible presentation of the witness tampering charge, the constitutionally insufficient mens rea, impacted the carjacking conviction.
It's a plain error issue, isn't it?
It is plain error because we didn't raise this jury instruction First Amendment issue below. So it is subject to plain error review. That's correct.
Is this issue within the limited grant that the court made?
Yes, because the remedy for if you conclude the statute is unconstitutionally broad or needs to be construed as I'm advocating for, is obviously reversal of the witness tampering conviction, but then it could fairly also encompass reversal of the carjacking conviction based on whether the armed bearer is harmful beyond a reasonable doubt with respect to the carjacking conviction.
We understand your position. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Dean Chen.
Thank you, Chief Justice Ramner. May it please the court. I will not take much time at all. I really only have 2 points. First, on the central issue of whether the witness tampering statute regulates expression or speech. Even putting aside the particular facts of this case, if you examine the text of the statute itself, while I agree, Justice Fascelli, it does use the word conduct, it inherently defines the crime in terms of the reaction or response that conduct engenders in the mind of a third party, the witness, and not just any reaction or response, not one of general anxiety or fear, but a specific response of providing false testimony or withholding evidence or any of the other specific results. That act of transmitting into the mind of another, that specific an idea, is inherently one of expression and communication. Now, I absolutely acknowledge.
If someone were prosecuted for standing outside of somebody's house, mm-hmm. how is that prosecution for expression?
Well, under this statute.
Defendant, let me be more specific. A defendant who is not acquainted with the victim, who apparently has the address and who just stands across the street on a public sidewalk and looks at the victim's house.
Well, if we're speaking, how could such a person be prosecuted under the statute?
No. How is that prosecuting for expression?
Well, it would be, I suppose, the symbolic expression of trying to, of engendering fear in the other party.
So that's expression?
It is communicative. I think it would be unprotected, but it would be.
I'm just about to ask you that. Is it your position that there is a First Amendment right to engender fear in the victim of a crime?
Absolutely not, Justice Patterson. All I'm saying is that once the statute has been found to regulate expressive activity, then the constitutional protections that the courts, and particularly the Counterman case in the context of this case, come into play to make sure that a state statute only properly intrudes on expressive activity, because the ACLU quite acknowledges there are some types of expressions and speech that the First Amendment does not protect. However, once the statute has been found to regulate expressive speech, we do have special constitutional tests that are required to protect against intruding into protected speech, such as, in this case, the requirement of Counterman that the mens rea requirement be something more than it was in this case, as counsel noted, the fairly unusual case in which it's a civil negligence standard. Counterman clearly required at least a subjective standard in which the criminal defendant had some subjective awareness of the...
Let me ask you about the civil negligence standard, because as you're aware, that's the world in which I practice. And when you have a civil negligence standard, the individual who is being judged under the reasonable person standard is the defendant, the civil defendant, the person who is alleged to have committed a tort. Okay, so you look at whether the person who is the defendant, the actor, acted consistently with a reasonable person standard. This isn't quite that. This is not acting. This is not a statute that requires a jury to look at whether the defendant acted reasonably. It is asking the jury to look at whether the victim, a reasonable person in the victim's circumstances, I'm not quoting it exactly, would be prompted to take certain actions that are obviously antithetical to the search for the truth in a criminal trial. So when I've heard repeated references, this is just civil negligence, but the civil negligence, yes, it uses the term reasonable person, but it's it's reasonable person being the tort defendant, the person who allegedly caused the harm.
But
this is really something different. I'm sorry.
It is holding the criminal defendant responsible for what a jury would determine, and now actually a hypothetical reasonable person would construe his conduct to be. In a way, it really is putting the criminal defendant at a double risk of trying to predict.
No, it's not asking the jury to figure out what the reasonable person thinks the defendant did. It's asking the jury to figure out what a reasonable person would do as a result of the conduct. See what I'm saying? I'm not commenting on the general issue of constitutionality, but that is not a civil standard.
Well, and certainly the label of civil negligence standard is not necessary to the core of the argument. It clearly is a standard that falls well below what Kahneman requires, which is that the criminal defendant himself have some conscious awareness of how his words will be interpreted, rather than hypothecating how a reasonable person would interpret those words.
How do you square that then with the general charge that the judge gives the jury on what knowingly means? And in particular, I mean, I have the statute right in front of me. A person commits an offense if, this is the witness tampering, he knowingly engages in conduct.
Well, certainly, I think the knowing applies to the act itself, which in this case really does not seem to be in dispute. No one questions that Mr. Hill wrote the letter, and presumably that act of writing the letter was intentional, purposeful, intentional, or knowing.
It's not knowingly writing the letter. It's knowingly engaging in conduct, which a reasonable person would believe would cause a witness or informant to, and that goes on.
I think the natural interpretation of that statute, yes, he knowingly engaged in conduct of writing a letter, but it is the effect of that letter in the mind of another that is subject to this reasonable person standard.
And as to Justice Patterson's contrasting a reasonable person in the field of tort law and as it's used in this statute, the judge charges the jury that the state has the burden of proof prove each and every element beyond a reasonable doubt, and knowing is one of those elements that must be established in this statute.
Again, I return to my interpretation that the knowing element in that case regards to the actual act itself of communicating the letter, which is really not in dispute in this case. The second point I wanted to make, Your Honors, without...
Can I just pause you on that? And I apologize for that. When you say it's not in dispute, that clearly appears to be the case, but it is relevant to the question whether the statute is overbroad, because it is not going to apply by its very terms to speech that as to which that knowing element is not established beyond a reasonable doubt. The fact that it's not in dispute here is not the central point.
I'm trying to imagine a situation in which the communicative act that triggers this reaction in the third party was not intentional. The act of communication wasn't intentional, but somehow accidental. I'm not.
So here's a hypothetical that may resolve that. What if the defendant was putting out leaflets, mm-hmm. not realizing that the victim's house was one of the ones getting the document? Mm-hmm. But there was, you know, the defendant's address is there, the picture of the defendant, and now the victim gets a picture of the defendant with a communication at her home. Does that sort of fit?
Then I suppose there would be two factual issues. Was the act of communication intentional? But and even if it was the reaction that it triggered in the reasonable person, in a reasonable person's view, that it would trigger in the witness's mind, rise to the level that Counterman requires, which it very well may not, certainly if it's instructed under the current statute.
And so you're advocating or arguing at least that one interpretation of the statute is that there are essentially two states of minds that apply in reviewing the statute. One is the defendant's intention of actually making the communication, and then the second part is how that then becomes interpreted by a reasonable person, which is a lower standard.
Yes, Your Honor. That's right. Justice Norrie. The second point that Astley wanted to make, which is a point that it has made in cases, in similar cases, including State versus Calvin Fair, which I know the court heard a few weeks ago, is its concern about these crimes that depend, these expressive crimes that depend upon the reaction of some third party or a victim. In Calvin Fair, it was the alleged victim of a threat case. And that is these types of crimes, while not, of course, not inherently on its face unconstitutional, do raise the danger of implicit bias in how messages like that are interpreted. We are all subject to implicit biases through our backgrounds and how we were raised, and we will interpret different languages, different symbols, different acts differently. And I think there is a danger when one subjects a criminal defendant too much to the vagaries that can be injected when the crime is measured in some way by the reaction of a third party. That is all the more reason. We're certainly not saying that that means that such crimes are inherently constitutional. It just provides an additional reason why the constitutional protection, such as the heightened mens reis standard that applies in this case, should be implied in full force in cases like that to avoid the dangers inherent in implicit bias. I'd be well happy to answer any further questions, but that's all that Amicus had.
Thank you. Ms. Sean.
May it please the court. The ACDL agrees with the position of the ACLU that the statute is unconstitutional and that Mr. Hill's conviction should be reversed. I would just like to briefly make 2 points. One, the statute does in fact regulate speech, and therefore is subject to Counterman's holding that there should be a subjective mens rea, and that has to be recklessness or something more than recklessness. Here, Hill was not convicted because he merely sent a letter, but clearly because of the contents of the letter itself, which was read to the jury. Very little conduct, save those that are explicitly violent, or as one of the justices pointed out, stalking, will ever fall within the ambit of the statute with also involving speech. And as Dean Chen had pointed out, it's because the witness there has to be some form of communication with the witness in order for them to testify falsely or to not testify at all. It is our position that the statute as written does burden speech more than necessary. The second argument that I would like to point out is, as this court found in Pomianic, if a person of reasonable intelligence cannot discern the dividing line between lawful behavior and criminal behavior, then the statute is unconstitutionally vague. And as this case intersects with the First Amendment, an ordinary person will not know, may not know, that the mere act of talking to the witness or contacting the witness is criminal. And because the state
counsel vagueness is not before the court, is it?
No, Your Honor. We submit that because the state bears the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant had to have the subjective intent to engage in criminality, Mr. Hill's conviction should be reversed.
Thank you. Mr. McAdam.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The state respectfully requests that this court affirm the appellate court's decision, specifically its determination that the New Jersey witness tampering statute is neither facially overbroad nor overbroad as applied in this case. To start with the facial challenge, our case law makes clear that facial invalidation is used sparingly as a last resort, and that the burden here on the defendant is a high one. Not only does he have to show that this statute went further than permissible and necessary to fulfill the state's interest, but he has to show that this statute encumbered a real and substantial amount of constitutionally protected speech or conduct. The state's interest here, as discussed in Crescenzi and again below, is a fundamentally important one that goes to the very heart of our judicial system. It is the interest in preventing the intimidation of and interference with witnesses, informers, victims in criminal matters. And this case also involves a statute that by its plain reading regulates conduct, not speech. Any speech that may be wrapped up in this statute is incidental. This is a statute that targets conduct, making the burden on defendant here even higher. Up against this high burden, the defendant does not provide sufficient real and substantial examples in our case law where this statute encroached upon constitutionally protected conduct. On the other hand, there are numerous examples in our case law where the witness tampering statute was validly applied to regulate unprotected conduct. And in the Attorney General's brief, they list numerous examples just within that subsect where the statute regulated unprotected conduct. For example, murdering a witness to prevent them from testifying in Adams, or taking a witness across state lines to prevent them from cooperating in Seabrook, or altering an arrest report in Conway, are all examples where it was purely conduct that was regulated under the statute. And even if there were examples provided here and there, the occasional case that does have a fact pattern that may touch upon speech considerations, facial invalidity is still not the the right solution here for those cases. For one thing, not all speech that might be implicated by the statute is necessarily protected speech. In Burkert, the court found that that the state is allowed to criminalize speech that furthers criminal conduct. Also, expressive conduct is not necessarily protected speech just because the actor is intending to convey a message. If that were the case, as the U.S. Supreme Court reasoned, any law could theoretically be challenged as infringing on some form of expression. And defendant, to address defendant's claim here that that the statute does infringe upon pure speech, again, without providing a real or substantial amount of examples of that, the solution is not facial invalidity. It is to, if there was a fact pattern that came before the court that seemed to have some merit with regard to pure speech, the solution there would not be facial invalidity. It would be to address that in an as-applied challenge. And then just to turn to the as-applied challenge here, defendant claims that his speech was infringed upon by this statute, but he was not charged with witness tampering based on any language, any content, any expressed idea in the content of that letter. He was charged with witness tampering because he engaged in the conduct of sending that letter to the victim's home, making it clear to her that he knew who she was, where she lived, and that he was willing to act on that knowledge. And that's what implicated witness tampering here. With this content-neutral application, the focus was on the time, place, and manner by which he engaged in this conduct and relayed this to the victim. And it was really the inappropriateness of the place and manner specifically here that made all the difference. A reasonable person here, represented by the jury, could look at that conduct and reasonably find that the victim would react that way, would react to that conduct by engaging in one of the five enumerated actions here, ultimately hindering the proceeding. And in fact, the jury here did hear from the victim during trial. She testified that when she received that letter, she made no comment specifically on any language in particular. She said when she got that letter and she realized who it was from, she became terrified and she seriously reevaluated whether or not she felt safe continuing to cooperate with the proceedings.
But didn't your adversary say if all you wanted to admit was that a letter was sent, it had nothing to do with the content of the letter, and then the victim testified that, you know, the fact that she received the letter scared her, then the letter itself wouldn't have to be admitted into evidence. The jury requested specifically to read the letter, a typewritten version of the letter. Then they had to listen to a readback of the whole letter. The prosecutor in closing specifically talked about how the jury should read the letter, relied on the text of the letter. So how is that consistent with the argument that you just made that it has absolutely nothing to do with the text of the letter and it's just about the fact that any letter was sent and the envelope could have been empty?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it's interesting to try to square the two positions that the defense takes throughout this whole proceeding, where on the one hand, they're saying that the actual wording in the letter was innocuous, that there was nothing in there that would be anything other than a pleasant letter. But on the other hand, they're saying, sorry, I lost my train of thought. The act of getting the letter made all the difference. Even though the jury asked to hear or asked to read the letter, asked to look at it, the defense is making the argument that nothing in that letter would suggest witness tampering because it was a innocent letter sent with nothing
wrong with it. So really, when you're looking at why the jury would have found witness tampering here, and really, I think the powerful thing that they heard was from the witness, was from the victim herself, who testified that it was the act of receiving it that made her reconsider all of this. But
you could see how defendant could have, in theory, argued at trial, you know, no, the contents of the letter were innocuous, and the prosecutor could have said, even okay, we agree the contents were innocuous, it is the fact that the letter was sent, and it informed the victim that the defendant knew where she lived, and that's why it was threatening. But instead, the prosecutor at closing said, no, go read the letter, you know, read all the words in the letter, you'll be the judge.
I think it's impossible to look at the jury, whether or not they took the prosecutor's summation and gave it more weight than the victim's testimony. I would imagine the victim's testimony made the real difference here. And when she made it clear that it wasn't the actual content, it was the context in which she received the letter that made her engage in or possibly consider engaging in one of these five enumerated actions, that before the jury would have made all the difference in their decision to find defendant guilty of witness tampering here.
Counsel, the distinction, as to the distinction between conduct and speech that you're stressing, suppose this were a case that involved two individuals that knew one another from before. The defendant and the victim had been friends, had been associates. And afterward, the defendant sends a text message to the former friend, happy birthday. Is that enough to sustain a conviction under the statute?
Under that fact pattern, Your Honor, likely not.
Wouldn't you need to look at content as a result?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. In that regard, receiving a text message, you know, the reasonable person here, as the jury, would put themselves in their shoes and they would say, yes, I received a text message to my personal device, but it's not from, I know how this person had that number. In that case, the time, place, and manner would seem to be reasonable. So then maybe you would look at content and find it's not a threat. It's nothing that's not protected speech. And in that situation, I think the witness tampering wouldn't be charged or shouldn't be charged under that fact pattern because it wouldn't seem to run afoul of any of the elements here. And I don't believe a reasonable person looking at that would find that it ran afoul of the statute.
Depends on the circumstances.
Correct, Your Honor. And that's here. It again here. If you took the content of that letter, and you put it in a newspaper, or he said it during an interview, or any other different time, place, and manner, you have two different cases there, where the content of the letter is the same, but the way that it was relayed is different, and that makes all the difference as it pertains to witness tampering and as it pertained in this case. Because again, it wasn't anything in that letter. It was the fact that she got it at her home and realized that her assailant in this violent carjacking not only knows where she lives, but he's willing to do something with that knowledge.
So why then, going back to Justice Van Raptor's question, introduce the letter altogether?
Theoretically, Your Honor, I don't think, to satisfy the witness tampering statute, I don't think the jury needed to see the content of that letter because the circumstances around how she received it were more than sufficient here to satisfy it. As Justice Wiener Apter hypothesized earlier, if she had received a letter that had nothing in the body of it, but just enough on the address line to make it clear who it was from, that's enough right there to satisfy the statute.
Yes. In your experience, would you agree that 10 out of 10 prosecutors would likely introduce that letter?
Your Honor, I suppose it's possible. I suppose it's even likely. But again, for the purposes of the witness tampering statute, they don't necessarily have to.
Under your theory of prosecution there, is it fair to say that a defendant is uniformly barred from ever contacting a victim outside of the context of a no contact order?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. And to that point, it actually, it's surprising to hear from the defense claiming that this statute is overbroad and an overbroad incursion into speech, but somehow the solution is to have more no contact orders across the board, is a strange solution when no contact orders are more restrictive on speech than what this statute does. because I think there are circumstances, or there at least could be circumstances, where maybe not advisable, but and I'm sure any defense attorney would advise against it, but there might be situations where a defendant could engage in some form of contact with a victim or a witness or anyone without necessarily running afoul of the statute. Again, whether or not it's advisable is one thing.
But your example a few minutes ago, if this defendant had just sent the envelope with nothing inside of it, that would have been enough to satisfy the third degree under the statute.
Correct.
But where's the threat or the implication, other than simply acknowledging that he knows her address, which is in discovery and is possibly publicly available? Where's the intent to do anything wrong there?
Your Honor, the statute doesn't necessarily look to whether or not there was a threat, especially when it involves third degree witness tampering, which specifically does not. Or says it's something where there's not a threat or a threat of violence or anything like that. So it's not necessarily dispositive whether or not there's a threat there, so much as it's just how a reasonable person would react to getting that letter sent to her private address.
But under those circumstances, then, I think the suggestion is that in any violent case, any communication by the defendant to the victim that suggests that they're aware of where they live would be enough to trigger a reasonable person to believe that they're being compelled not to go to court or not to testify, not to participate, and therefore triggering a third-degree witness tampering charge.
I think more likely than not, any situation in this regard that something like this gets sent to a private residence is more likely to lead to implicating this statute, because that is conduct that does put a victim in a place of, or reasonably could put a victim in a place where they would engage in one of these. The fact that this was sent to her private residence rather than some third location, or whether it was broadcast online, would have been entirely different here. The fact that it was a private residence is very crucial to why this was ultimately did run afoul of the witness tampering statute.
Your adversary says that the New Jersey statute is the only one in the country that has a negligence standard. Do you agree?
Your Honor, I was not able to find another witness tampering statute that had a similar structure to this one. I would note, just because it's unique does not make it unconstitutional. And I would also note that while I didn't find one that mirrored our statute, I also didn't find that 49 other states had statutes that were exactly the same, and this was the one outlier completely. Looking through other states, I found a wide array of differently structured witness tampering statutes.
This has a mens rea of knowing. This is not negligence.
There is a knowing element to this. Correct, Your Honor. The knowingly engaging in the conduct. There is one aspect of this that does have a knowing element to it.
And another aspect that is with regard to whether the reasonable person would believe that the conduct would cause the witness to do the resulting conduct.
Correct, Your Honor. And I would note, in our criminal code, there are many statutes that involve conduct-based crimes that do use a reasonable person standard to measure criminal culpability. And again, it is the state's position this is a conduct-based statute that may incidentally touch on speech, which our case law says is, for conduct-based statutes, that's not necessarily a problem as long, you know.
Is that similar to the statute, the stalking statute in Counterman?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I would say the stalking statute is remarkably similar in grammatical structure and legislative history to the witness tampering statute here. In Gandhi, this court found that the statutory structure of that statute was permissible, and also the knowing element only applied to the first part, not to both parts. And I would also say that would be true here, because again, they are very remarkably similar in structure. The appellate court in BA then weighed in on the constitutionality of the stalking statute as structured by this court, and found that that statute wasn't overbroad and it wasn't vague. And while that case didn't, the cert was denied for that case in front of this court, as it stands now, the stalking statute as it currently exists, and as it is very similarly structured to this one, was determined to be neither unconstitutionally overbroad or vague.
I meant the stalking statute in Counterman.
Oh, I apologize, Your Honor.
Okay.
So just to be clear, when I answered, I was referring to the New Jersey stalking statute. But to address Counterman, Counterman dealt with a fact pattern that did deal in speech specifically. And the question there was, is it protected speech or is it unprotected speech? And, you know, examining the true threats doctrine specifically. And ultimately, that court did determine that in that speech context, when the content and the wording of that possible threat makes all the difference, in that case, we need a reckless standard, is what the court there decided. Here, we're dealing with a conduct-based statute where that same consideration does not exist, certainly for the vast majority of cases that touch on witness tampering. For the small subsect of cases here that might, one could imagine a witness tampering case that might touch on speech incidentally, whether or not you might need a similar reckless standard specifically and only exclusively for those kind of cases, possibly, but again, that could be remedied on an as-applied basis, certainly does not require or and should not lead to a facial invalidation here.
So in Counterman, Justice Sotomayor, in her concurrence, she argued that the stalking prosecution, that was not a true threats prosecution, and that was a prosecution for an offense that just involved threatening statements. So in that regard, she agreed with the majority that for that particular prosecution, that the recklessness floor, the recklessness standard should be applied, but didn't agree that for true threats prosecutions generally, the court should have gone further and determined what the mens rea should be for true threats prosecutions generally. So under her logic, wouldn't this statute, this witness tampering statute, be similar to that stalking statute in that it is a criminal offense that may involve threatening statements, but doesn't have to involve threatening statements. So it's not necessarily a true threats prosecution. And in that regard, we should find that there should be at least a mens rea of recklessness with regard to the second element of the witness tampering statute.
I don't believe that necessarily needs to be the result here. Sort of for that expressive conduct, again, a smaller subsect of what is generally just pure conduct as witness tampering in New Jersey is applied. For that expressive conduct, to quote from what Justice Fischelli said earlier, the idea that when you have the non-speech and the speech elements, there is some justified limitations on the First Amendment. So I would say here, again, on an as-applied basis, if there is a case where there's expressive conduct, if there might be some limitation on the First Amendment, it's not necessarily an unconstitutionally overbroad incursion into the First Amendment.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
Otherwise, Your Honors, I would just rely on my brief and on the brief submitted on behalf of the Attorney General's office.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chin.
May it please the court. When the state brings a prosecution for witness tampering, the offending behavior can come in several different forms. That tampering often takes the form of pure, non-expressive conduct, like assaulting the witness or conspicuously lurking outside a witness or victim's home, in which case the First Amendment isn't implicated at all. Even where the tampering involves speech, there are multiple types of applications that pose no First Amendment problem, as in cases of bribing a witness or encouraging one's co-conspirator to commit perjury. Or the prosecution might be neutral as to the content of the speech and instead hinge on concerns with its time, place, or manner, as when the speech occurs at the victim's home or minutes before she's about to take the witness stand. It's only where speech is at issue and none of those justifications applies that the state needs to rely on the true threats exception, and thus has to prove a reckless state of mind consistent with Counterman versus Colorado. But because Mr. Hill challenges only that narrow slice of applications, He hasn't met his burden to demonstrate a lopsided ratio of unconstitutional to constitutional applications.
Wait, I'm sorry, I wasn't sure I understood. Were you conceding that in that narrow slice, then under Counterman, recklessness would have to be charged?
Yes, in cases where the prosecution has to rely on the true threats exception, we of course agree that under Counterman, the First Amendment requires the state to prove recklessness.
So under this statute, that would only be first and second degree witness tampering?
Yes, I think that's, if the state is proving a threat, then it might implicate that upgrade to the second grade offense. I think that distinction in the grades underscores that it's only a kind of a narrow category of these applications that are going to hinge on a threat. But because he's only challenging that category of applications, we don't think Mr. Hill has demonstrated substantial overbreath. Because there is no facial overbreath problem, there's no basis to grant facial relief striking down the statute. And because there's no facial problem, there's no basis to adopt statutory limits as a facial matter under the guise of
constitution. Let me ask you about what slice of or category of cases defendant is challenging, because he was only prosecuted for the third degree. This was not a lesser included offense. There was never any question that the state was going to try to prove the more immediate threats that would be required for a higher degree. So the challenge here, as I understand it, would be those cases that are within the third degree, which would implicate speech, and unlikely that virtually any true threat case would fit into that category. Am I right about that?
I think you're right. It would be a narrow band of cases. You can imagine a hypothetical case, but I think the more important point is that there's a large swath of pure conduct cases that don't implicate threats, that don't implicate.
What about cases that are speech but aren't true threats? I think the reason I'm confused is it seems like you're asking for more First Amendment protection for something that's a threat of violence than for something that is speech that is not a threat of violence. And usually the First Amendment is the opposite in that threats of violence are protected less than words that are not direct threats of violence.
So I don't think we're disagreeing. I think it's there's only going to be a small share of prosecutions that need to rely on the true threats exception because the statement is one threatening violence and it doesn't satisfy the First Amendment in any other way.
So let's say this prosecution, how do you think it satisfies? It's not a true threat. So what First Amendment exception is it satisfying?
So I think whether you think of it as under the O'Brien paradigm or content neutrality, we think this is just a content neutral restriction on speech. The problem here was really the manner in which Mr. Hill approached the victim, contacting her directly at her house, which showed that he knows where she lives, knows her name, and is willing to contact her outside of proper channels. And that's really what drove liability, not the words of the letter. If you hold the content of the letter constant and just vary the place and manner, if he had sent the same letter to his brother, if he had published the same language as an open letter on an internet blog, That wouldn't be witness tampering, which I think underscores that this application is neutral as to the content.
So, are you saying that this is that in essence that aspect of the third degree tampering statute is a valid time, place, and manner stress manner restriction on speech?
Yes, and I think that underscores that the cases that come up to the second degree because they're relying on a true threat of violence really are a small share of what this statute is doing. And I think it's going to return to Justice Pierre-Louis' questioning about there are many ways to violate the statute through conduct alone. I think that's exactly right and highlights the problems with challenging this on overbreath grounds. Mr. Hill argues that even the conduct applications communicate a message to the witness or the victim potentially, but that doesn't bring it within the First Amendment's ambit because, you can imagine a defendant who kills three witnesses in order to intimidate the remaining two witnesses from testifying. That obviously communicates a message to the two remaining victims, but that doesn't make it protected by the First Amendment. What the state is punishing there is murdering someone, not the message that's being conveyed. And so I think that's O'Brien explains why a case like that is still, it's completely prescribable under the First Amendment.
So let me just follow up on that, if I may. So the overbreadth test would involve the question whether the prohibition reaches a substantial amount of constitutionally protected conduct beyond that what may be legitimately outlawed. And I think what I'm hearing from you is that in the third degree setting, you know, the higher degree crimes may implicate true threats, but in the third degree setting, there is a very small amount of constitutionally protected conduct that would be implicated in real life because of the nature of that offense.
That's exactly right. If the state is not even charging under the upgraded offense and alleging that there is a threat of force, then I think that's, you know, by definition, you're not a case that's relying on the true threats doctrine. And either that's something that is pure conduct. I mean, you can have a threat of force through non-expressive conduct, or it's an application that involves speech that satisfies the First Amendment in some other way.
And am I right that the category of speech that the narrow category, which you were saying is not excessive in terms of what is being potentially implicated is really the window or the daylight, as it were, between defendant doing an op-ed or a blog post or whatever, making this point, and his actual conduct that's alleged here, which is sending the letter to the victim.
Yes, I think a case like this is a good example of one that is not going to rely on the true threats exception, because it's really the place and manner of speech that was driving liability and not the exact words. And the comparisons to the Facebook post or the op-ed, I think, just drive that point home.
But how do you square that with the prosecutor focusing on the words of the letter, admitting the letter, the jury reading the letter, the jury, because there wasn't a typed version of the letter, getting a readback of the whole letter? I mean, it was not a case where the prosecutor just said, the only thing that matters here is the defendant sent a letter to the victim at her home. Here is the envelope.
And I think we would make a distinction between the kind of evidence the state is relying on and what facts are really driving liability. And here, I think the only way that the only facts that get you across the line and establish a violation here is the place and manner, the manner in which he sent this letter to the victim. So if that had changed and it was in a manner that was not inherently threatening, a public internet post or you know, sending it through his defense counsel is something that is not itself inherently threatening. That shows why the content is not what was driving liability here. And I think ultimately Mr. Hill's strongest and maybe only example of a potentially unconstitutional application is just this application to his own case. He hasn't pointed to other prosecutions or applications that are actually constitutional. He notes that there are a lot of speech applications in the cases, but I think that just begs the question, which of these First Amendment exceptions applies? He does agree that even with speech, the speech integral to exception and, you know, content neutrality are exceptions that are always in play here.
Speech integral to the offense.
Yeah, speech integral to the offense. So I think a great example of that is speech integral to bribery. Defendants bribing witnesses is something you see a lot in the cases. So just to identify that this has been applied to speech in some cases, really it is not a complete analysis. It just kind of begs the question, which First Amendment doctrine are we in? And so I think ultimately there's really just one example of a potentially problematic application of the statute. That's really nowhere near what's needed to show overbreadth. I think, you know, Virginia versus Hicks explains well that, especially when you're dealing with a statute like this, which is trained on conduct and not speech, it's pretty rare that you'll be able to establish overbreath. You have to prove overbreath from the text of the law and an actual fact. And so with just one application that is really the focus of concern, that's not enough to prove overbreath. I'd just like to briefly address the avoidance arguments, and that under the doctrine of avoidance, you should raise the standard to knowledge. I think there's two problems with that. First is that this just isn't an avoidance case. Avoidance applies where there's a reasonable constitutional application of the law and another reasonable interpretation that would leave the statute invalid. We do that because we presume the legislature means to act constitutionally and also does not want its enactments to be invalidated wholesale. But when you're choosing between two interpretations that are both leaving the statute valid, you're not avoiding a constitutional problem. That's just disregarding the legislature's intent. I think the avoidance arguments also falter on their own terms here, because this is not a gap filler statute. There's no gaps to fill in the text of this law. This is much like the stalking law in that this court construed in Gandhi, where the legislature spoke clearly that the conduct element had one mens rea, which was purpose or knowing, and then clearly chose a different mental state element for the results or the reaction of the victim. And just as this court in Gandhi explained, that's not a gap filler statute. We're just giving effect to the legislature's clear choice. This is too. So we don't think avoidance can be invoked to excuse a defendant or a challenger of meeting his burden to establish overbreath. We think just ultimately the existence of some cases that would rely on the true threats exception that would have to meet recklessness under Counterman, that's a small enough sliver that there isn't an overbreath problem with the statute.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Flynn, bring us home for the day.
I agree, Your Honor. First, I'd like to kind of address Justice Fasciale's construction of the statute, because what we just heard the Attorney General say is that knowledge element does not modify the reasonable person standard in the statute. That's how the appellate division interpreted it. That's how the jury was charged in this case. So we're operating with respect to defendant's awareness of his speech on a purely objective standard, not a subjective one. So that's a problem for threats cases under Counterman. And as Justice Wiener after pointed out, it's actually a problem for the third degree charge as well, because why would threatening speech have a higher level of protection, a greater mens rea than non-threatening speech that's apparently being charged in the third degree case? And these third degree cases like this one that are gonna be based on speech, when there's conduct that like implies a threat, they'll charge second degree. A third degree case such as this, or I cited 20 cases on page 10 and 11 of my response to the Attorney General, where it was based on text messages, letters, in-person conversations, telephone calls. And to the extent that those cases deal with non-threatening speech that is directed at getting a witness to testify false or withhold testimony, I think the appropriate exception would be the speech integral to criminal conduct exception. And as I argued at length before, that requires a mens rea of at least knowledge. So I would suggest that the best solution to that problem is to read the statute as Justice Fasciale suggested, so that knowledge element modifies the reasonable person element. In other words, the jury would be explicitly charged that in order to convict defendant, you must find beyond a reasonable doubt that he was aware that the nature of his speech was of the nature that would cause a witness, of a reasonable person, to believe that a witness would withhold testimony. So in other words, there'd be a subjective aspect to it and an objective component. And then that would put the statute clearly within a constitutional application. Otherwise, if you're doing what the state asks and you're only applying a higher standard in the second degree case when threats are involved, you're leaving a large swath of at least as applied challenges when the third degree charge is being based exclusively on speech.
And that adds to that knowing point that you just made, counsel. The definition of knowing talks about awareness in terms of high probability and practically certain. And those are parts of the definition of what knowing means. So that is already part of the charge that the judge gives.
Right, but the way that the appellate division construed the charge as being read, and the way that I believe it is right, is that that knowing element is only elevating that he engages in conduct, that here that Mr. Hill knows he sent the letter, not that he knows the nature of the letter. And regarding that high probability language, I know I advocate.
Right, what did you just say? I want to hear what you, what distinct, you're saying that he knew he sent the letter, but not that he understood the nature of the letter?
Right, that he didn't understand that the contents of the letter would cause, is of the nature that might cause a witness to not testify or to testify falsely.
Of course, if we accept the AG's argument, this is not speech at all. It's simply conduct, and it doesn't implicate the First Amendment.
I mean, for the reasons discussed, I think this is...
That seems to be one of the arguments.
But that has, if you believe that in all applications is purely conduct-based, then yes, then it would not be a First Amendment problem. But I think the record in this case and in other cases belies that position.
What were you about to say about high probability?
So I advocated for that in my brief, but I actually don't think it would be necessary to charge that part of it. So that's, there's two sentences in 2-2b2 that define knowledge. The first defines a person acts knowingly with respect to the nature of his conduct if he is aware of the conduct as that nature. And then the high probability has to do with results. So the witness tampering statute actually doesn't, you know, obviously require the witness not to testify.
No,
so I think,
isn't it a more stringent standard than Counterman?
It would be a more stringent standard than Counterman. The reason I'm advocating for it is since there's already knowledge in the statute, I think the gap filler could apply. If I distinguished Gandhi in my brief, and, you know, Gandhi wasn't dealing with constitutional avoidance. So I think you could still get there.
I'm sorry, I missed it. Did you say it is or it isn't a higher standard?
It is a higher standard.
Higher standard than Counterman.
So, yeah, the reason I'm saying that recklessness couldn't be read into the statute is because it just doesn't appear in the statute's text. But even if you did want to do that, Mr. Hill's conviction would still need to be reversed. But the other reason why, one of the other reasons I'm advocating for knowledge is that that would bring this statute within the ambit of the speech integral to criminal conduct exception. And then, you know, whether the speech is threatening or not, it would be unprotected because it's done with the knowledge or intent that it, you know, the person commit another crime based on that speech here, you know, testify falsely.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel for the helpful arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement.